And I got out. I come running back to you. I come running back to you. Yeah, I come running back to you.
Welcome to the Wayne Bennett Podcast, celebrating West Virginia's people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now here's your host, Wayne Bennett.
Welcome to Wayne Bennett's podcast. My name is Wayne Bennett. This is episode 103. It's June the 9th, 2023. And I'd like to give a shout out to the band Alabaster Boxer. Nick Durham is the front man, and he's also the snowman on the Buzz 93.5. Nick's going to be on our program here in a week or two, and he's a former student of mine. Today, our guest is an athlete. He's a teacher, businessman, grandmaster in martial arts, entrepreneur, and most of all, friend, Mr. John Maynard. Welcome, John.
Man, it's so good to be here. It's good to be back in West Virginia, and it's a little bit cooler here than I'm used to, but I'm always blessed to be back around my family and friends.
Well, John is living primarily now, I guess, in Wilmington, North Carolina. The first thing I was going to make a comment, and I thought about it probably didn't affect you, but your dad had he was the only person I knew that had a pitching machine in the backyard. Yep. Were you around then?
Oh, yes, sir. Sure. Yeah.
And you don't meet too many people like that.
Right, right. Now they're pretty much commonplace, but back then it was, it was ahead of its time.
Yeah, it was. And your dad was Sarge Maynard, and your mom, Jan, two of my favorite people.
Mine too.
How's Jan doing?
She's doing great. We've had some time together. She likes to get out and move around a little bit. She is, I won't say her age because she's going to hear this, and she looks wonderful. She's doing great, and I'm just very proud of her, especially for what she did after Sarge died. She kept Jimmy's place alive, and it was a big struggle for her. And then, once the pandemic came, it was time for her to get out. And she didn't need to be around the smoke anymore and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So she just needed to get out of that. She has COPD, and she doesn't need to be around it. Nobody does.
Well, I've written about this before. I met your dad I was about 11 years old. And we used to have a Sandlot baseball team, and he was coach out at Little League. We had a lifetime relationship, and he did that with a lot. He spent a lot of time working with the youth in the area, and the contributions he made, the show's not long enough to mention everything.
And all of you guys and girls had something to do with that. I mean, you've been in, service to people for your whole life, your wife also. And just what he did will never be done again with the amount of teams that there were and the amount of kids that were on the field. And at one point, Beckley Babe Ruth, I think they had like 17 teams. It was just amazing how many teams were out there.
Wow. Yeah. And I was thinking the other day, I thought about some of the families that I knew, the Odells, the Lanes, the Hearns,
McGraws, Lusks,
Wicklines.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Mannings, Richmond, Fregill. I mean, there was Daniels. All these people. It's not just the boys playing ball, but yeah. The parents helping out with running the league and making contributions. And it was. The Babe Ruth had kind of died down there for a while, but another family, the Liebers, are trying to rejuvenate with the help of Dave Barksdale, and they're heading in the right direction.
They sure are. Yeah, I'm happy to see that.
Yeah. Did you play any other sports other than baseball?
To be quite honest, Wayne, I really was never that great of an athlete, so baseball was my only venue. When I was younger, I played football. I played what is now not a politically correct term, which is called midget football. And so I played that. And, from there, just really, my father's 6 foot, was 6 foot four. My mother's 5 foot, and I got somewhere in between. So wasn't ever a very big person, So, yeah, baseball was my out, and, you know, I was fortunate to have a little bit of success and had a lot of help getting there.
What position did you play besides pitcher? I know you were a good, great pitcher.
Yeah, I did play a little bit of infield, but most of the time it was just pitching, especially when I got to high school, and I played for a great guy. His name was Coach Parham, and, you know, it was just I just pitched.
Yeah. Now, you graduated in, what, 80?
81.
81. And the 80 team went to the state finals.
Yes, sir, and I pitched in that game, and I hit the first three batters. And Parham came out to talk to me, and I was like, Coach, please don't take me out. And the rest of the game, that would cleanup hitter cleared the bases. They scored three runs and didn't score anymore after that. And that was the greatest defensive game that, you know, I've ever witnessed. And I had a great seat for it. And the guys just gave their all. You know, I mean, they made plays that were impossible. And I was never really a strikeout pitcher. So, you know, they did just fantastic work. John Chandler was on first base, and, you know, Cole Certo was in center field. And we just had some great players. And they did an amazing job.
Well, you had there was some pretty good pitchers on that team. Those were Ron Fama, yep. Tim Epling, right. And Mason Bastion. Of course, he was excellent infielder, and I remember that much. Your dad coached you in Babe Ruth, didn't he?
He did for a while, and to his credit, he decided he was being too hard on me and gave up the coaching position to another person, and so he could concentrate more on not chewing me out so much and working with other people. But what a great testament to him that, you know, he knew he was being a little bit rough on me. And
so there were some other people that when you were younger, that adults that might have influenced you positively, teachers or coaches, or do you, anybody that comes to mind?
Two of them in this room, you and your wife, you know, Chuck Littlejohn, just people, again, Parham, just people that were always there trying to do different things. Like, I work for your wife at the city pool, and there, you know, there's always kids there. You were always doing something. I would always see you with people, and just that positive influence. Pete Colasurto, you know, they were always doing something with kids. And, you know, then I guess Woodrow was a lot bigger. I think my graduating class was like 611.
Yeah.
But, you know, just had a lot of athletes come out of here, a lot of really good athletes.
Who was your favorite baseball team when you were growing up?
Well, because we're here, obviously we had to root for the Reds or the Pirates. So, you know, now it was for many years. Trot Nixon played for the Boston Red Sox, and he was the reason that they made it through, you know, game four to break the curse. And he hit the home run to keep them in the game. And that had never been done before. They won four in a row. And he trains with me now in Wilmington, North Carolina. That's where he's originally from. And Trot's a great guy and gives a lot of stuff back. But, you know, I guess now my favorite team is still Boston because of Trot, or I guess anyone but New York.
Well, I think that's a general feeling.
Yeah.
Sorry about that, Jim Sears. But, I was always a Reds fan, of course, because I'd go to sleep at night listening to the Reds ball games. And the first team I ever saw play was on a little league excursion to Washington, D.C., and I became a Senator fan.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a lot to cheer about.
Right.
So I follow suit with the Nationals, and so now my teams are the Pirates, the Reds, and the Nationals, the Nationals and the Reds aren't doing too hot. The Pirates are actually playing pretty good ball for them.
It's funny, I was looking up some stuff the other night, and Perry Pirkowski came across my mind, and looked up what he had done, a veteran, and played for, I guess they called the Cincinnati Redlegs.
Redlegs, yeah.
And he was in the bigs for quite a while. And obviously, you know, I just love Joe Goddard, and he's just done so much. And he would talk about the amount of days that he was in the big leagues, and, you know, he wasn't there very long, but the greatest thing that I thought was funny, he said, I never had to touch my bags. I didn't have to carry my luggage. And he thought that was just so wonderful.
And, you know, those guys didn't get paid a lot.
No.
You know, and they,
no.
I mean, the pros back then had to have other jobs,
yeah,
you know, to survive.
Well, Catfish Hunter was from Wilmington, North Carolina. And even then, they didn't make a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't until free agency came around. I don't think they were making. Now, when did you start? You graduated from Woodrow in 81. Did you? And you went to Marshall.
I did. I started out. I played almost a year of ball in Florida at Seminole Community College, and you play there every day, and no excuses, but my arm just couldn't hold up, my body couldn't hold up, and so from there I ended up at Marshall, and I tried out again at Marshall, and I was, from all that I know, I was going to make the team, but my grades were lacking, so I couldn't do that, and that would have been great. And Dave McKinney, Woodrow Wilson fame, played for Marshall, played shortstop for Marshall then.
Jack Cook was a coach.
Yes, he was. Yeah, sure was.
Yeah. What kind of music did you listen to back then? What is your favorite?
Oh, man, I've always been a Bob Seger fan, Marshall Tucker fan, and growing up in Jimmy's Place, Beckley, West Virginia, you've got to listen to some country music. So obviously I'm a Waylon fan, Hank Jr. and Senior fan, but I'm a little bit of everything. I find myself now listening to some new people, like Morgan Wallen and just some great new country singers. And, there for a while, country music I wasn't really happy with, but it's kind of gone back the other way. And some really good country out there. Jamie Johnson, Chris Stapleton, doing some really great
country. You're naming my favorites.
Yeah.
Well, you actually started training in karate when you were about, 7, 8 years old?
No, I started when I was about 12, and Sarge got me in it because he wanted me to learn to be able to help myself a little bit. And I trained back then with Butch Jackson and Click Bandy. They used to train at the old Woodrow Gym and just kind of dabbled in and out of that for years, and then ended up here with Tracy Cook and some of his black belts. But, ended up getting my black belt, I think it was 81 or 82, and from there, started playing ball, tried to dabble in it then. But then once I went to Marshall, I got hooked up with some people there. My instructor there, his name was Danny Lane, who was one of Chuck Norris's guys. And so we ended up with that organization, which is then called the Chuck Norris Organization. And so, in fact, I'm going next month to the convention in Las Vegas. And, Chuck Norris is doing great. We'll say he's at least 80 years old, but he's doing great.
Now, I saw around the 81, I guess, I don't know whether you graduated or not, or this was just a summer thing, but I saw a picture on the internet that the big league all-stars, you guys had some of you guys like Kevin Lindsay and Kenny Mayola, Jack Bowman,
yep.
Larry Gart. Now,
David Lusk, just a bunch of great people.
Tommy McClung was in that bunch.
Yeah.
And then I think when you played in the Industrial League, I think Doug Epling was a coach. Were you on that team?
No, the West Virginia Glass.
Yeah.
Bob Cernuto was coaching then.
Okay.
And man, what a great guy. Man, he put a lot of money into that and just always made sure we were fed and had water. And we traveled quite a few different places, and he was just such a good guy.
He kept that Industrial League going for years.
Yeah, he did. And that's out of his pocket too.
85, you decided to open up your own.
Right, I was living in Huntington, West Virginia. I moved back here, and we came back here and opened up a place, and it did really, really well. And it was a Champion Martial Arts, which is what we still are today. And then all of a sudden, there was a coal mine strike, and I went from being okay to nothing. And so that's when a friend of mine from here that was a doctor said he's moving to North Carolina and wanted to know, hey, we'll try to do something there. And so at that point, he ended up in a place called Elizabethtown, North Carolina, which is close to Wilmington, North Carolina. And I said, I think Wilmington's the place to go. And one of my friends, Doug Thompson, he was doing something for the government. He said, John, all the indications that we have is Wilmington is going to go nuts. And it has.
Wow.
I mean, it's that region is the fastest growing region in the country. And it's just, you can't keep up. We have like 100 people move there a week. It's just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, Rick Luoni and Steve Maynard, they kept the thing open up here.
Yeah, for years. For years they did.
And they still got that? Got anything open around here?
Rick now lives in Charleston, South Carolina, and he's a priest. And Steve is still here working for the Turnpike, and he does some stuff out of his house. You know, he's got a home gym.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, no, there is a good martial arts school here. It's at the mall, and darn it, I can't remember the guy's name. I'll think of it in a second. But he does a really good job, and he's one of Chuck Norris's guys.
Now, Steve had, when I was working at Park, he used to have some competition up there. I'd let him use the gym yep. on Sundays, and they would mark off.
Yeah, they'd do a little karate tournament. And,
yeah. And he'd have pretty good crowds,
yeah,
too, man.
Yeah.
It was good turnouts
yep.
there. He did a good job with them.
Yeah, he did. He did it for a very long time. Yeah, very proud of him. He kept that show going for a long time.
Now, you got hooked up with Chuck Norris sometime right around that time. And he was the epitome of.
That's when he had gotten very big, and the name had to be changed from the Chuck Norris System to the United Fighting Arts Federation, because that's when Chuck had signed the deal for the 3-picture deal for Missing in Action. So the namesake Chuck Norris was, I guess, bought or leased for X amount of years. And after that, you know, I think it was a 25-year period, and then went back to the Chuck Norris System. But, yeah, man, I was very fortunate that I was on the Chuck Norris team. We were the first team to go to the Soviet Union, and we went there in, gosh, 88, I think.
I think I saw that.
And, boy, I don't think I was ever more proud to be an American until after I got back from that place. I was like, Lord have mercy, if I ever died and don't make it to the right place, I'm going to get sent here, because that place was horrible.
Really?
Terrible people. I mean, Americans, we're just so blessed with grace and what we've got in this country. And it was just amazing to me to understand. And I don't even know, gosh, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this. I don't know that I was even a great American until then, maybe not now, but boy, I became one then. I'm like, heck with this other deal.
Now, Chuck had, some of the movies, Good Guys Wear Black, mm-hmm. and Code of Silence, yeah. Missing in Action, You Miss. And his technique was a multitude, and not just one particular way, but a multitude of how to achieve certain circumstances. The United Fights.
Fighting Arts Federation, UFAF, yes.
Are there other federations?
Or? Sure, there's all kinds. Yeah, so there's, okay. There's the American Taekwondo Association. There's the AAU. That has their own karate organization. So there's many different ones, many different styles, you know, and they do different things like MMA, the mixed martial arts stuff that you see on TV is just, it's a combined of martial arts, boxing, kickboxing, wrestling, judo, jiu-jitsu, a lot of different things. And, you know, when that first started out, it was just kind of anybody that was a jiu-jitsu stylist, the Gracies in particular, they, you know, people weren't prepared to get drugged to the ground and get, you know, choked unconscious. So the great thing about Americans, we stole everything they had, and now we're better at it than they are. And I love that about America. You do something better than us, we're going to take it. We're going to make it, and we're going to make it better. And it's just really cool that
you
see how far that's come.
You were a 5-time world champion within the United
Fighting Arts Federation, yes, sir.
Now, how did that work? Do you... You go out, you compete, and they give you a point. Is it a point
system? Yeah, it's a point system. So it's not a full contact style. It's a point style where you score, and they give you a score. It's more like what you would see on TV in the Olympic style and stuff like that.
Yeah, so you don't fight to a submission
no.
or anything like that.
But, no.
But it still requires a lot of physical discipline
yeah.
and aggressiveness.
Yeah, you've got to be in a little bit of shape, and you've got to, you know, just have your mind right at what you're doing, and just go out there and do your best, you know. And I had a little bit of success with that, and again, with the help of a whole lot of other people.
Now, you were a 2-time Chuck Norris Competitor of the Year.
Right.
And now, one time, I don't know whether it ever happened or not, but you were going to be cast in a movie with Nick Nolte, Sister Mania. Did that ever happen?
It did. And it's out there, and you can see it. And there's this very famous chimp. His name is Charlie the Karate Chimp. And he was in that movie, and you can still get pieces of it on the internet. And, you know, being in Wilmington, I've had the great opportunity to work in a lot of different movies and do, you know, some stunt stuff. And my face is made for radio. It's not made for TV. So, you know, I'm usually either a bad guy or getting beaten up, one of the two. And it's, you know, it's always nice to do that. I did get the opportunity to work with Mr. Norris one time on Walker, Texas Ranger. And that was, you know, that was great.
Did you ever get a byline on a movie or, I mean,
a speaking part?
Something like that. Well, no,
but when I was working for SAG, which is Screen Actors Guild, the money is so very, very, very good. And I worked one complete day and I made a lot of money and then got residuals, you know, off of that. So, I mean, you know, you work and you make, you know, $1,500, $2,000 a day, and then you'll get residuals, you know, four or five different residuals for $500, $400, $300, $200, $100. And right. Yeah, so it's
you can live off that.
Yeah, you can. Think. Yeah, you can.
Now, yeah, I know one time we were down Myrtle Beach and you had been down in the area for a while and you were thinking about opening a three-level bar. And right in the middle of Myrtle Beach, right close to Ripley's, believe it or not, what happened with that?
Let me make this a very short story. I am not a good bar manager, and opening a three-story bar in Myrtle Beach, it does really good in the summertime, and it does nothing after those 3 or 4 months. So you know, it was a very short-lived business.
Can't even think of nothing.
Moguling, you know, so yeah, I did horrible, you know, it's all there is to it. But
that was an enormous task anyway. I mean, my gosh.
Well, you know, I never go at something thinking I can fail, but, you know, one of those things, I probably should have thought about that a little bit more. And of course, Sarge told me not to do it, and I went ahead and did it anyway. And so there you go.
Other than Jimmy's Place, did you ever have any other bars or try the bar?
No. You know, I've learned my lesson on the bar business and in business in general. Most businesses fail, especially, I mean, in the bar restaurant business, you're looking at a 99% failure rate. The food and bar business is a very hard business. And I, you know, tell anyone that, especially people that come from here, they're like, John, we're going to move to Wilmington. We're going to start a little restaurant where we can just work part time. And I said, you're a fool. You have no idea what you're getting into. And if you want to lose money, you know, start a fitness center, martial arts school, bar business, and a tanning bed. Put them all in under one roof, and that way you can get it over with a lot quicker. And it's very hard in the business world. And, you know, it's people that do that and stick in it for a long time, especially the mom-and-pop places, Jimmy's Place. I mean, businesses just don't last that long.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, I guess, that made Jimmy's Place successful, the family lived in the bar.
Yeah.
They were basically the only employees. Mm-hmm. And it was a tough profession.
Yeah.
And I mean, you have to count your pennies and you put up with a lot of.
Oh my gosh. You see people at their very best and you also see them at their very worst.
Yep.
And it's, I mean, you have to be a psychiatrist, psychologist, you know, when you're tending bar, and it's not the easiest thing in the world. And, you know, bartending can be a big burnout thing because, you know, you've got to be on your best all the time, greeting people and, hey, how you doing? And there's a lot of days you don't feel like doing that.
Yeah.
And, it's like I have the opportunity to train a lot of police officers and I always tell them, I said, all you got to do is be perfect every day. And we're human. We're going to fail. That's all there is to it. And when you mess it up, unmess it up and get right back on the horse. Hey, man, I'm sorry. Let's get this moving.
Now you once, after Chuck Norris kind of went the movie way and you got away from the system, you started picking up Joe Louis, who was a world kickbox champion, and his technique, his system, and it's not Joe Louis, the boxer from the 40s and 50s.
Right, not the Brown Bomber, who is my hero. I love the Brown Bomber. He's the greatest in the world. I know I'm getting off tangent here, but he defended his title 13 times in 17 months, and that's never been done. He was treated horribly by our government, and it just, what a great testament to America, man. I just love that guy so much. I watch films of him. Every week we're watching something. I make our guys watch that, and just the great things that he did. You know, he got beat by Max Schmeling coming out of the, you know, it was in the 40s. And then second fight, he knocked Max Schmeling out. And it was a big morale boost for America.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I got off.
Well, tell us about the Joe Lewis.
Joe Lewis, the golden boy. Okay. He was first world karate champion, first world kickboxing champion. And he's from a place called Nightingale, North Carolina. He went to Hollywood. Things didn't work out there for him. So he ended up, fighting and became the world kickboxing champion. And but he ended up living in Carolina Beach, North Carolina. And I found out he was there and went and knocked on his door one day expecting to maybe get punched in the nose. But I said, "Hey, sir, my name's John Maynard, and I would like to train with you if at all possible." And he says, "You don't want to train." I said, "You know, that's just Joe. I mean, he could start a fight in church." But, had a chance to work with him. I ended up doing some movie stuff with him. I ended up doing a bunch of exhibitions with him. It just became a very, very dear friend, instructor. Loved him very, very much. He passed of brain cancer, but was in that organization for a long time. And, you know, a lot of times organizations or businesses don't last after the demise of their leader. It's very hard to keep it going because that spark that makes everything go is just, it's not there. And it's hard to keep that going.
Yeah. You there was a quote from you. I think you said, "Sometimes a teacher, always a student."
Always.
Are you still using the Joe Lewis system?
I mean, if you look at it, everybody does. He was really the first person to bring American kickboxing or make American kickboxing. He was the original American kickboxer. It wasn't even here then. And if you look at anything that's going on anywhere now in the pugilistic world, there is boxing and kicking in that. And it is more of a combination thing now, whereas karate people were always thought it was like the Bruce Lee people. And this is now just a continual process of being able to kick, punch, clinch, throw, grapple, wrestle, ground, whatever. And it's just, you know, it's become very eclectic and full circle.
Now, you spend a lot of time training law enforcement.
I do.
And what all is involved in that training?
Well, what I try to do is, and by the way, God bless our folks that keep us safe, they're having a tough time right now. And, you know, we have to have law enforcement. We have to. It is a must. They have to be respected. And, you know, I think, you know, nobody wants to see the popo until you need them. And but they are a needed entity, and, you know, become friends with many of them. And I've had the good fortune of training thousands of them. But what we do is I do something called gross motor skill. And our system is called OSBD, which is Offensive Strategic Body Defense. And offensive means that the situation has become offensive. So you have to do something about it. Police don't have the opportunity to leave. They have to stay. And, you know, a normal person, when things got really crappy, you know, you have the opportunity to get out of there. They don't. And so what we do is what's called gross motor skills. And these are God-given skills. You're going to do these things no matter what. And we work it from that position. So, in other words, if somebody throws something at you, even if you're hit with it, your hands will still go in front of your face. You can't help but do it. If you fall down, you'll put your hands in front of you, unless you've had too many beers or whatever, you know, so, or unless you're unconscious. So we just make everything from that gross motor skill point, and we teach, get hands on them, get them turned around, get them on the ground, get cuffs on them, and get them out of there. If that's what it requires. If not, then the verbalization, everything, you know, goes from there. But my job starts after the verbalization has broken down. And it's not that it's mean, it's just about control. And the quicker you can get control of any situation, the less people get injured, hurt. So you've got to get control. There's a reason that law enforcement says, turn around and put your hands behind your back. It puts them in a better position to be safe, and the offender and the law enforcement person. So that's the whole goal, to do as much as you have to do to get this under control and as quickly as possible. Again, the longer this lasts, the more people get injured.
So you're talking about using passive restraint as if necessary, but you also had a quote too, the only thing that stops violence is violence.
That's it. So if someone is at this point, if someone is being violent with you, and I'll spout out a bunch of statistics here, but 67% of the time, once an attack starts on a police officer, it continues. Once they hit the ground, it's even worse. So what happens is if you're in a crowd and the police officer gets knocked to the ground, or in a fighting situation, a lot of times people get hurt there because they're getting kicked or stomped. And that's where people really get injured is the ground. I mean, that ground is a tough thing. And when you're hitting it hard enough, it hurts. And, you know, at our age, hitting the ground is not something fun. I mean, we all fall down, and it's not a fun thing. So, yeah, once violence has started, the negotiation's over with. You have to do something about it. And you have to prepare people for, we call it the three, which is shock, disbelief, and acceptance. You have to get to acceptance. You've got to get there as quickly as possible. Accept what's going on. And I talk to people about, like, if you've ever been in a car situation, a car wreck, where you see somebody pulling out, and you're like, no, boom. You got to the point that it's not happening. Oh, gosh, it's going to happen. Oh, it just happened. So you're at acceptance at that point. And the quicker you can get there, the better off you are.
Now, you also have training films on firearms. And
yes.
Before we get into that, have you ever in your personal life had to use your skills? I mean, have you ever been someone has attacked you or pushed you to the point you've had to do it?
I've worked in the bar business for 30 years, so we'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
There's always times when people need some help with whatever they're trying to get to, you know. So if they're trying to hurt other people or bothering other people or hurting other people, again, you have to take action to do things about it. And I have done quite a bit of security work in Wilmington, which they hire me as a driver. So
now you've made several training films, some of them including guns, those type of things. You're the founder, and you have a patent on on-point sights and trainings. I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. Well, what it is, and for those of you out there that are dyslexic, you'll understand. We are taught from a young age to close one eye and shoot a firearm. So me being from West Virginia, my math is amazing. So if you close one eye, you've lost 50% of your vision. You've also lost fighting mindset, and you've lost depth perception. So you have to keep both eyes open. So for some people, it's very hard because we're all taught that we're right eye dominant or left eye dominant or whatever. Well, your brain is dominant. Your brain tells your eyes what to see. Your eyes don't tell your brain what to see. So your brain has to recognize it before your eyes can make it work. So as an example, if you look straight out and you break your vision, your brain will try to fix it. And that's why the eyes start going a little bit funny. And especially with someone like myself who is dyslexic, it changes things a little bit. Your brain is a little bit different. And so I developed a sight where I put everything on the front of the gun, and it's nothing crazy. It's just you have your front and your rear sight on the front of the gun. And there's going to be people out there going, there's no way. We're talking about in reality-based combatives, statistically, law enforcement, their hit rate is about 18%. And that's from a combative distance, which is 0 to 10, and most of that is 0 to 5. Hmm. And a lot of it comes from their draw to getting to center and understanding what to do, how the firearm works. And we're all taught these really cool things on how to shoot and what to do. And as Sarge always taught me, pick up the gun, point it at the target, shoot. And he never said anything about sights or anything like that. And so we do something called flash sighting, where as soon as you see something and you're on target, you release your round and try to keep the gun stationary.
Now you're talking about how successful your business has been in the Wilmington area. It's a hustle, though. I mean, tell me a typical day in Wilmington in your business.
Well, my day starts, I have a Belgian Malinois out in the car that was a gift from the sheriff's department. It was also a curse. And I didn't know what I was getting into. And it's a very high drive dog. We get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning, I make some food, throw something in a sack, and we go out, get ready to get to the gym. We do our walk, run, throw the ball. From there, you know, it's 5:15. Time we get to the gym, it's 5:30. I've got people at the gym at 5:30. 5:30, we start personal trainings, which I have a lot of people that are very successful that can afford that. And we do trainings, private trainings, from about 5:30 in the morning until about 11. At 11 o'clock, the dog and I go back, do some stuff there. I come back, try to get my paperwork done. And as much as I dislike being on the internet and looking at stuff, I have to do that. We have to do billing. I have to set up other trainings. You have to return phone calls. 1 o'clock, you know, we try to grab something to eat. Once that happens, we're back ready to go at 2. We have personal trainings from 2 to 4:30. 4:30, we start classes from 4:30 to 8:30. We have classes every 45 minutes.
Wow.
So it's a long day.
Is it 6 days a week or 5 days a week?
The 5 days a week were that long. On Saturdays, I don't have to start till about 7:30, so it gives me a little bit more time.
Get a little sleep.
Yeah, but you know, people like to train, and so I work 7 days a week. I have three or four trainings every Sunday also. So
yeah.
And in business, if you're not willing to get out and do that and willing to hustle, and you know somebody calls wanting to trade your time for money, you know, that's what you have to do.
What happened during the COVID? How were you affected during the COVID?
Horribly. Our wonderful governor there shut us down for 2 years. And I borrowed a bunch of money, received some money from some assistance. We stayed open for a little while. And for some reason, the health department ended up at my front door. And at that point, I was keeping the door locked and, you know, knock on the door. We'd like to come in and talk to you. And I said, who are you? And we're from here. And I said, I got nothing to say. And so it was just terrible. There was a lot of our, you know, civil liberties that were just very, it's just very disturbing at that time. And, you know, now we know a lot more about it. And just hopefully we never have to go through that again. And hopefully as Americans, we've learned to stand up for our rights a little bit more too, because a lot of those were taken away. And that's not being, you know, Democrat, Republican, good, bad, or ugly. That's just constitutionally a fact.
Yeah. Now, you've got the business built back up and everything's doing
yes.
great?
Yeah. It took quite a while to do it. Again, once people get out of the habit of doing something, it's not, they don't usually get right back in the habit of doing it. And, you know, where we charge quite a bit where I am, you know, you go to Planet Fitness or something and it's $10 a month. And I don't understand that business model, but for some reason they keep it going. And, you know, I'm just a small business, and that's one of the reasons I try to support so many small businesses, you know, so you don't go to the big box stores and you don't go to Amazon. And oh my God, I could go on forever about Amazon, but man, it is super, super convenient, but it hurts a lot of small businesses.
It does. And just for the general knowledge, what's happening with Jimmy's Place? You say you're out of the bar business, but you still own the bar.
Yes. Well, my wonderful mother still owns it. She,
yeah.
But a gentleman took over, and I'm going to say his first name right, and I'm going to butcher his second name, but his name is Dinesh Lamachink, something like that. And I just call him Dinesh, and he's a great guy, a hard worker. He owns a couple of other businesses. Man, I go up there. I love their food. Just the atmosphere is different. You know, one of the things that people say, you know, John, Jimmy's Place is just not the same. And my answer always is the only thing that happens is change. You have to be willing to change.
Yeah.
And if you're not willing to do that, I mean, now they have the internet and they do this animation thing. You know, they have these like parties, like kind of like some Star Wars during our time. People would dress up in Star Wars. And, you know, Sarge walked in there today. He was like, what the hell is going on in here? You know, it's the times. I mean, look at what you're doing now. You would have never thought you'd be doing a podcast.
And I didn't even know what a podcast
exactly,
was.
I'm
10
with
years
you.
Ago.
No, that's what I'm saying. And so if we don't keep up with that, you know, we have to, or you just get left behind. And I'm behind now. I bet you feel the same way. I mean, yeah. You know, I get on my phone and something happens to it. I got to get one of the kids out of the class to come and fix my phone.
Absolutely. But, well, that's, my wife and I went in there right after he opened. It only had been open a couple of weeks, and he was just selling juice and some food. He didn't have his alcohol license or anything like that. But I have talked with people, and he's got comedy shows, he's got music,
yeah.
He's got people
yeah.
coming in, and it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, people like me, I'm too old, I'm not going to support it too
yeah.
much.
No, I'm with
I
you.
Don't get out.
Yeah,
but,
I'm with you.
You. Know, he's appealing to the right generation, and good luck to him.
Well, hopefully, if the college does good, you know, hopefully we can get some more people there, and you know. A lot of people in the bar business thought that was going to be the answer. And I'm like, you know, kids in college are not 21, you know,
yeah.
But now they have the internet. So they have different things that they can do with kids that aren't 21. And, you know, he's very good about getting the IDs, checking people. I mean, nobody wants underage people in their bar. Nobody does.
No,
it's too much trouble. Something's going to happen and it's just not worth it. And he feels that way too. Every bar owner, I'm sure, does.
Well, John, you're, hovering around 60 years old now, I guess.
I'm on the other side of it, brother.
And what's on your bucket list? What I always ask this: What are you looking to achieve? It can be business wise, personally. What would you like to see? It might be several things. I don't know,
man. You know, I guess this is going to sound ultra patriotic, but you know, I just want to do as much as I can for my country and our veterans. I'm a member of Post 10 American Legion in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I spend a lot of time there with a lot of veterans. And we do, you know, there's meals there. We do outreach. They do a lot of programs to help vets with their insurances and their injuries, whether internal or external or mentally, physically. It's a great post ran by a great commander, and they do just so much. They have a breakfast every Saturday morning, which is $5, and you'll have to have three plates to take home with you. I mean, you know, it's just, it's amazing what those guys do. And, you know, my goal is to, you know, I guess like Sarge, I want to help as many young people as I can. But, you know, now I've got people that their grandkids are coming to me from Wilmington. So, you know, it's kind of full circle. And again, the instructor has become the student. I don't teach a ton of the classes. I have guys that are at a much better skill level than me and much younger than me that teach classes, but I still get out there and, you know, do a lot of private trainings and teach a couple classes a week. And, but it's, you know, just try to do better for my community and my country.
Did you ever get married?
I did.
Did you?
Yes.
I didn't
And, that was, didn't work out too well. My fault completely. And don't want to go into that, but, married to a very great girl, and we're still friends to this day. And, I have a very wonderful significant other in Wilmington, North Carolina, and her name is Kimberly Lenora Lynn, and she is a product of Carolina. And when you hear her talk, she sounds like a Carolinian. She cannot say water. She says water. It's funny to hear her say things, and you hear Southern people say stuff and they just can't keep from doing it, but it's amazing. She's a great girl.
Well, one of my favorite quotes, is if you give anything less than your best, you sacrifice the gift, and you sure haven't sacrificed the gift. You're doing a lot of great things, and you know, I'd like to get you back on here sometime.
Well, I got something I wanted to give you. It's kind of the last of the Mohicans, so.
Oh man. Oh boy, that's classic. Jimmy's Place T-shirt, man.
You know who that belonged to, so wear it with pride.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. I thank you. And I appreciate you coming by and talking to us, and I've enjoyed it. And like I said, invitation, you can come out anytime. Anything else you want to say?
Or? Man, it's a blessing and an honor. It's good to be alive and be in Beckley, West Virginia. God bless everybody.
All right. Anybody else that'd like to be on our program, you can contact me at awbennett50@gmail.com. And remember, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet. Until next time, God bless you. Them hills and